The world waits to see what Iran will do following Israel's military strike.
I do hope they will realize that the best way to go would be to stop attacking Israel with ballistic missiles.
Harris and Trump are making their final appeals to voters.
Trump campaigns in battleground states later in the week after a Sunday rally at New York's Madison Square Garden. Harris is also scheduled to visit all swing states in the coming days.
And a preview of the COP29 climate conference in Baku.
COP29 is dubbed the Finance COP. So wealthier nations that are responsible for most carbon emissions are set to negotiate contributions to help other countries build resilience against climate change.
Today is Monday, October 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Starting off in the Middle East, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says that his country has proposed a two-day ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, during which four hostages held in Gaza would be released, as well as an unspecified number of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. The plan also includes the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza and more negotiations for making the ceasefire permanent. As of this recording, there is no immediate response from Israel or Hamas. Meanwhile, Israel is bracing for a possible Iranian response to its strikes on Saturday against Iran. Israel says the strikes were precise and targeted and focused on military targets in a number of areas inside Iran. Iranian media reported that four soldiers were killed. VOA's Linda Gradstein has the story from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials say the bombing attack against Iran, which reportedly used more than 100 aircraft and hit 20 military targets in Iran, was successful. They say the operation, codenamed Days of Response, was a rejoinder to Iran's ballistic missile attack against Israel 3 weeks ago. Daniel Hagari is the Israeli Army spokesman.
Simultaneously, we targeted Iran's surface-to-air missile arrays, an Iranian area of capabilities that were intended to restrict Israel's aerial freedom of operation in Iran. Israel now has broader aerial freedom of operation in Iran.
Iran's military said that only radar systems were damaged in the Israeli strikes. A Saudi news site said one of the targets was a ballistic missile facility that was destroyed and that will take 2 years to rebuild. The exact extent of the damage done in the Israeli attack may take a while to understand, according to Israeli analysts. Benny Sabti is an Iran expert at Tel Aviv's Institute for National Security Studies.
The results are not in the social media. They are inside the bases. There are walls around all these bases. The people cannot see the damage. Maybe we can only see it from the satellites after a few days.
Israeli analysts say that the choice of military targets as opposed to nuclear or oil facilities was a calculated decision to avoid escalating the conflict. Eyal Pinko is an intelligence expert at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies.
There is a huge pressure from the Biden administration in the last 2 or 3 weeks not to go into escalation. I believe that Israel, because of the dependency of Israel in the shipment of ammunition from the U.S., Israel didn't want to upset Biden and Harris. So I think that the target that were chosen, which are military targets, a facility for drone manufacturing, anti-air systems.
Israel is braced for a response from Iran, but some analysts say Iran is likely not to respond. Shlomo Shapiro is an intelligence expert at Bar-Ilan University.
I do hope they will realize that the best way to go would be to stop attacking Israel with ballistic missiles, because if the Iranians would retaliate now, that may drive Israel to an even harsher response. And that could escalate into a regional conflagration.
Israel says it hopes that the series of strikes will end the tit-for-tat exchange with Iran. But officials say Israel is prepared for any Iranian response to the attack. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Well, We'll be taking a look at the U.S. election in a few moments, but there's other election news around the world to catch you up on. We begin with Japan, where it's the end of the road for the ruling coalition. Dan To of Reuters has more.
Japan's ruling coalition lost its parliamentary majority in Sunday's general election, with voters punishing Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba's party over a funding scandal and inflation. Public broadcaster NHK has reported that Ishiba's Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, and junior coalition partner Kameido have fallen short of the 233 seats needed to secure a majority in the lower house of parliament. They previously held 279. The loss raises uncertainty over the next government's makeup in the world's fourth largest economy, and is the worst election result for the coalition since it briefly lost power in 2009. The biggest winner of the night is the main opposition, the Constitutional Democratic Party of Japan. The party secured at least 143 seats, up from 98 previously. Ishiba called the snap election right after being picked to head the party last month, in hope of winning a public mandate for his premiership. He said he would wait until the final results before considering potential coalitions or other power-sharing deals. His predecessor, Fumio Kishida, quit over a scandal involving unrecorded donations to lawmakers, as anger also grew over a cost-of-living crunch. The election outcome is likely to force parties into fractious power-sharing deals to rule. That could bring political instability as the country faces economic headwinds and growing security tensions in East Asia.
Dan To of Reuters with that story. The party in power lost national elections in Lithuania as well. The Homeland Union party leader, Gabrielius Landsbergis, told reporters on Sunday, as he conceded the race, that he hopes the opposition center-left Social Democrats will form a responsible government. And in another former Soviet republic, Georgia's ruling party is claiming victory following Saturday's parliamentary elections. However, opposition groups call the election rigged, as polls show that most Georgians want closer ties to the European Union, not to Moscow. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
Fights break out near a polling station in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. A local news outlet reported the men involved support the Georgian Dream Party and tried to provoke an incident. Georgian Dream denies involvement. Meanwhile, about an hour south of Tbilisi, a video shows a man appearing to cast several parliamentary ballots at once. The chaotic scenes come as Georgians decide the future of their country. At its core, they voted if their country would embrace the West and the European Union or pull closer to Moscow. With nearly all precincts reporting, Georgian Dream appears to have secured more than 50% of the vote, cementing its grip on a nation polarized over its political future. Georgian Prime Minister Irakli Kobakidze speaking on a Georgian Dream party feed as provided by the Associated Press.
The victory is so impressive and obvious. Among them, any attempt to talk about election manipulation and the conditions of electronic elections, an unprecedented pre-election environment. Of course, all their attempts are doomed to failure.
Opposition groups cry foul. The leader of the Strong Georgia Coalition, Anna Dolidze, speaking on TV formula as carried by the AP.
We are furious with what the Central Election Commission dared to present. The results announced do not reflect the will of the Georgian people. These figures, obtained as a result of elections held against the backdrop of widespread intimidation, fraud, and bribery, contradict historical and current choices of the Georgian people.
At the center of the controversy is Georgian Dream founder and billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili. Ivanishvili made his fortune in Russia, but accuses his opponents of working for foreign powers. Ivanishvili from a Tbilisi polling station as provided by the AP.
Either we are choosing a government that will serve you, Georgian people, Georgian society, our homeland. Or we are choosing agents of foreign country that will fulfill the request of the foreign country only.
European election observers questioned the conduct of the election as evidence of a democratic backslide in Georgia. The head of the European Parliament monitoring delegation, Antonio Lopez Isturiz White, at an international observers briefing as carried by Reuters.
Our European Parliament teams witnessed in some precincts high tension, confusion, and chaos. In one case, ballot box stuffing, physical assault on observers attempting to report on violations, observer and media removal from polling stations, tearing up observers' complaints, intimidation of voters inside and outside of polling stations. Furthermore, voting secrecy was not always assured.
If election results stand, Georgian Dream will have a parliamentary majority, potentially jeopardizing any aspirations of joining the EU. Georgian Dream earlier this year adopted laws similar to those in Russia used to crack down on free speech. The move led to protesters in the streets. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And here's some other stories we're following from around the world. A local official says Russian forces have thwarted an attempt at another cross-border incursion from Ukraine into southwestern Russia. On Sunday, an armed group sought to breach the border between Ukraine and Russia's Bryansk region, its governor said, but it was beaten back. There has been no immediate acknowledgement or response from Ukrainian officials. In Sudan, fighters from the notorious paramilitary Rapid Support Forces ran riot in east-central Sudan in a multi-day attack that killed more than 120 people in one town. It was the group's latest attack against the Sudanese military after suffering a series of setbacks. Residents in the northern Philippines are picking up the pieces following one of the deadliest storms to hit the country this year. At least 152 people are dead or missing. Experts say a mix of increasingly destructive weather, blamed on climate change, and economic desperation that have forced people to live and work in previously off-limit disaster zones has made many communities across Southeast Asia disasters waiting to happen. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at the U.S. election. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is running for re-election, has been called a fascist, and described as unfit to serve by several of his former top aides. But Trump's vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, rejects these accusations. Meanwhile, the Democratic presidential campaign runs ads on the controversy in battleground states. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports.
John Kelly served as White House Chief of Staff for former President Donald Trump from 2017 to 2019. In a recent interview with the New York Times, the retired four-star Marine general was asked if Trump was a fascist and replied, quoting here, "He's certainly an authoritarian, admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure." Trump reacted to the accusations on his Truth social media platform, writing, among other things, "John Kelly is a lowlife and a bad general whose advice in the White House I no longer sought," and told him to move on. On Sunday, Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance commented on remarks by Kelly and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, that Trump is a fascist. Vance was interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press.
"People who worked most closely with him, most of them are supporting this ticket. Mark Milley and John Kelly are both disgruntled former employees."
13 former Trump aides, however, released an open letter on Friday backing John Kelly's remarks and warning the Republican presidential nominee is, quote, "unfit to serve." Republican Senator Lindsey Graham strongly disagrees. He was interviewed on ABC's This Week show.
"I was around him. I don't think he's a fascist. I thought he was a very strong president at a time we needed a strong president. I think he will be a strong president to get this country back on track."
Targeting battleground voters, the Democratic presidential campaign of Vice President Kamala Harris has been running an ad with audio of John Kelly's remarks. Harris herself hasn't shied away from voicing similar concerns.
"Donald Trump is increasingly unhinged and unstable. And in a second term, people like John Kelly would not be there to be the guardrails against his propensities and his actions."
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who supports Harris's bid for the White House, was asked Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press whether he believes Trump is a fascist.
"I don't like using those words, but clearly he has a strong, strong tendency to authoritarianism and to undermining American democracy.
The controversy comes as both presidential nominees prepare to wrap up their campaigns. Trump campaigns in battleground states later in the week after a Sunday rally at New York's Madison Square Garden. Harris is also scheduled to visit all swing states in the coming days. She will deliver a, quote, closing argument to voters near the Washington National Mall on Tuesday. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
As the election nears, why is Donald Trump holding a large rally in New York's Madison Square Garden and not in a battleground state? And how is the overwhelmingly Democratic city reacting to the Republican candidate and his followers? We speak to Christina Greer, an associate professor of political science and American studies at Fordham University in New York City.
So many people are wondering why Donald Trump keeps going to places that don't seem to make sense on an electoral map. But we do know that this particular candidate likes to be in places with lots of adulation. We know that, you know, he has his sights on New York. He's obsessed with possibly winning New York because that would be such a surprise and, you know, obviously a major story that he's able to flip the state from blue to red. But we also have seen Donald Trump consistently going to geographic locales where there have been racial incidents over the past year, where, you know, either immigrants or people of color have been beaten up and or killed. And that is where he has chosen coincidentally to have the site of many of his rallies. So the fact that, you know, this is Madison Square Garden is where there was a massive rally in 1939 is not lost on many people. That he would choose this type of rally in the shadow of January 6th to come. And based on the reports that have come out thus far, the types of language and vitriol that is being spewed at that rally is quite dangerous. And so New York is a place where he's from. He feels very comfortable in New York. And I think he just wants to show that he has quite a bit of support in New York. Now, I'm not exactly sure how many New Yorkers are here, whether they're from New York City or Long Island or New Jersey or Connecticut. But he definitely has a crowd that is giving him the energy that he quite honestly hasn't had in a lot of his rallies as of late.
So I also want to touch on another thing you mentioned is that Donald Trump is a New Yorker. He was born and raised there. And Madison Square Garden is, to New Yorkers, a very important place, a very famous place, has a lot of history, a lot of significance to people in the city. Is it possible that all that other stuff is a coincidence and he just wants to be on the big stage in his hometown?
I mean, listen, the Garden is a magical place. I think what is very specific is that he is good friends with the Dolans, who are in charge, and they have been very clear that they are supporters of Donald Trump, as are many millionaires and billionaires. And so I think that is a locale that is in the center of the city where he can essentially show that he's got the type of popular support that, say, Kamala Harris, who's been filling stadiums night after night. I think this is a way for him to kind of get back on track. And, you know, we know that Donald Trump needs and wants to be a leader in the news cycle. And this is definitely a way to do it.
New York is a big city. It's a diverse city. How is the city reacting to Donald Trump and his supporters coming right into the center of town?
Yeah, well, thus far, we haven't seen any instances of extreme violence. There's obviously counter protesters who essentially say that, you know, hate doesn't belong in New York City. As you laid out, we are incredibly diverse city in all facets of the word. But, you know, there are many shades of blue in New York, and there are quite a few Republicans in New York City as well. So I think that, you know, there are people who still like the message of Donald Trump, who feel that New York is maybe getting too diverse racially and ethnically. And so I am curious to see, you know, where all these patrons are from, supporters are from. But I think we would be naive to say that, you know, there isn't a facet of New Yorkers who aren't intrigued by this message. But thus far, thank goodness, it has been relatively peaceful between his supporters and people who really do not have an appetite for this type of language in their city.
So when Trump speaks on Sunday, will he be speaking to New York, or is he really just using this as a springboard to speak to the entire country or to the people in those battleground states whose vote he so badly needs?
This is an opportunity for him to speak to his supporters and get his message amplified. Since he is in New York, we know that this rally will be shown in larger national and international networks. And so this is a shortcut, a cognitive shortcut for him to speak to his supporters, many of whom who have not been turning out to his rallies, because it is Madison Square Garden, because it is in the middle of New York City, and because he knows that he can get the media attention to spread his message faster than if he chose to have this rally in Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania.
So perhaps a shrewd PR on his part, no?
We have never said that Donald Trump isn't fantastic at PRs and or self-promotion. That may be one of his strongest cards that he has to play.
Christina Greer is an associate professor of political science and American studies at Fordham University. Professor Greer, thanks for your analysis tonight.
Thank you.
And finally today, representatives from nearly 200 countries will gather next month in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku, for the COP29 Climate Change Conference. Among other topics, the conference will focus on the money that wealthy nations give to less developed countries each year to help them cope. Charmaine Lee reports from Berlin.
Back in 2009, the wealthiest nations agreed to collectively pay $100 billion each year through 2025 to slash carbon emissions that contribute to global warming and support the climate adaptation needs of developing countries. But a 2021 UN report declared this figure to be obsolete, saying the need has skyrocketed to $6 trillion annually. Even before, countries struggled to fulfill their promises, according to the UN Office for Economic Cooperation and Development. Much of the money was also given out as loans instead of grants. This can put already debt-ridden countries in a dilemma. Gaia Larson, director of climate finance access at the World Resources Institute, told VOA News.
Well, certainly we don't want developing countries who are already dealing with too much debt, having to take on even more debt in order to deal with the crisis, in part because that means that many countries won't be able to invest in the resilience that they need. So they won't be prepared when the climate problems strike.
COP29 is dubbed the finance COP, so wealthier nations that are responsible for most carbon emissions are set to negotiate contributions to help other countries build resilience against climate change and deal with losses and damage. Public funds in the form of grants to less developed countries can help build a good base, according to Carolina Huri, researcher at the Center on Climate Politics and Security at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs.
The solutions for this have been that this NCQG could be this onion structure, like that there in the core of the onion could be the public finance in the form of grants, and then sort of the outer layer could be these some other innovative investment solutions. That perhaps then the contribution base there could be broader, but in the core there would still be this grant-based public finance.
As climate policies are often dependent on elections, Huri added that the U.S. elections in early November may have a massive impact on the COP29 negotiations. The United States is the biggest historic emitter, so its level of cooperation with the current biggest emitter, China, will play a major role in determining the outcome of the talks. COP29 is set to run from November 11th to 22nd in Baku. Sherming Lee, VOA News, Berlin.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. From Washington, I'm Steve Karish.